Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I'm looking at this Wordle board right now for today, and I just missed my third guess, and it feels like I've already lost. Getting four just doesn't feel like a win anymore. It's really sad.
I'm with you on this. Every day, my goal is to get three. I'd like to get my three total double my five total. And currently, I am at 76 threes and 44 fives. So I need 12 more threes to get to 88 threes, and then that would double up my fives of 44. I've been on a hot streak, I'm telling you. Getting four is disappointing, Maze.
I really hate the ones where you get to a point where it's either one or two letters, especially the one letter where there's like five words that you could still make. I get frustrated because the proper strategy is to like throw a bunch of them into a word and waste a turn.
That's only if you're playing on easy mode, Jordan.
Easy mode.
You can't do that on hard mode.
Huh?
You don't know about hard mode?
There's a hard mode, Jordan.
No, what happens in hard mode?
You have to use the greens and yellows.
Oh, you can't discard them.
You can't just burn a turn.
See, well, I have trouble doing that anyway because I get so frustrated. I'm like, no, I need to get this. I need to guess this one in as few turns as possible. I'm not sacrificing a turn. I'm not wasting a turn. But inevitably, I'll guess wrong.
I am boggled by this because I use Wordle.
No, that's a different game, Peter. Are you scrambled as well?
I'm scrambled because I use Wordle the same way that I use internet chess, which is not to extend my competitiveness, not to keep score, not even to get the brain off of analytics, just use letters and words in a fun, relaxing way. Usually, sometimes right before I go to sleep, I can't extend the strategizing part of my brain and my life to a word game. Good Lord.
But it is math.
Sure, but I don't need to know the percentage of the edge that I am losing by beginning with the word space instead of the word adieu, you know?
This is the biggest underdog upset that we've had on this show, is that Peter Keating uses Wordle to turn off his brain.
Yes, yes. If Danny Sheridan came to me and started screaming at me about which words were overlooking sandwich games, I couldn't handle it. The bowl is full, gentlemen, to the brim.
My starting word is crack.
Eight to shoot, Hall, the runner! Loose ball, it's good! With 4.4 to go, Shannon!
Don't want to foul!
Shannon, from the corner! And it's over! Gonzaga, the slipper still fits!
The cry goes up both far and near for underdog.
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 Joe Namath, number 12, has been the one big sidelight. He's come down here and he says the Jets are going to win. In fact, he doesn't even predict it. He says, I guarantee a Jet victory.
Oh, my kid, I ain't even in the guys' league.
In this lifetime, you don't have to prove nothing to nobody except yourself.
Underdog.
Underdog.
They're bigger, faster, stronger, more experienced. And on paper, they're just better.
Oh my goodness! The longest shot has won the Kentucky Derby! Rich Strike in a stunning, unbelievable upset!
Shock and awe in college basketball!
Underdog.
Underdog.
I expect you boys to go out there and not take this team lightly because I promise you, they're going to come at you with everything they've got.
Nobody's ever gone the distance with Creed.
11 seconds. You've got 10 seconds. The countdown going on right now. Morrow, up to Schultz. 5 seconds left in the game. You believe in miracles? Yes!
By George, the dream is alive.
With speed of lightning, roar of thunder, fighting all who rob or plunder. Underdog. Underdog. Underdog.
Well, then I guess there's only one thing left to do. Win the whole fucking thing.
Welcome to Underdogs. We're back. with another jam-packed show. We're going to look at the myth of momentum as we head down the stretch of the baseball season toward the playoffs. You hear a lot about teams that are hot, that are cold, that are playing well, that aren't. Does that matter at all in October? We've got the answer. And we got a few thoughts on a little show called The Bachelorette. But first, guys, second straight crazy week in the National Football League. What do we make of this? Crazy comebacks, more upsets, survival pools are down to 25% of their entrants. What the hell is going on? This is Underdog Central.
It's time to figure out which of these dogs are for real, right? I mean, I think it means week three is really important because, like, you can regress to the mean, but sometimes you're just so bad that you're just going to – the bottom's falling out, which is why you're not bouncing back. So we saw some crazy wins. I mean, I don't know. I'm trying not to be a homer and be local and point out that I picked the Jets, but that last couple of minutes of that Jets game was one of the most insane things I've ever seen, with the comeback scores sandwiched around and a successful onside kick by the punter, right? Not by Greg Zuerlein, who is kind of known for being able to squib the ball all kinds of different ways. So I thought that's what we were going to see. It was nuts. Did you think that was the craziest game of all on the schedule?
I mean, what about the Cardinals-Raiders game?
Yeah.
That was beyond insane.
Chris Cody said the Dolphins win was the greatest game he's ever seen. The greatest Dolphins win he's ever seen.
The Dolphins game, yeah.
Is it just that there's not a lot of difference between most of the teams in the league? Is this like the Danny Sheridan in-game theory that human nature takes over and you start playing harder when your back's against the wall? What the hell is happening?
It's totally possible that Danny is right about everything. I think Danny Sheridan bats 1,000 on these theories. I would never fade Danny's picks.
Well, I think his theory about bounce backs and underdogs and emotions led us straight into liking Tennessee, who did not have any kind of comeback in them and who I now think, you know, looks like they can go 0-17 for all I care, by the way. I mean, so maybe not. That was supposed to be the Danny Sheridan theory pick. Now, I'm not saying he picked them, although I think he did praise us for isolating them as the pick among the big underdogs that his thoughts would lead to. So I love Danny. Feel like he led me straight into a buzzsaw with the Titans, I have to say.
We had a pretty good week on our underdog picks, though, right? Other than I had to take the Bears, which I just hated, but you know, there wasn't much left on the board.
Maze, do you have the standings here? This is just my way of not tooting my own horn.
Yeah, Tom wanted to let everybody know that he's got 5 points on the season because he hit both of his picks last week.
That's right.
The Jags straight up embarrassed the Colts, winning by 24. So he got 2 points for that.
Yep.
And then the Texans covered, only lost by 7 to the Broncos. So he got 1 point for that. Peter picked the Titans, who got smoked by the Bills on Monday night by 34 points. And then he followed that up by picking the Jets, who came back and won by 1, so he got 2 points. He's on the board. Jordan picked the Bears to cover against the Packers. They lost by 17 because there was no monsoon this week. And then he picked the Cardinals, who somehow beat the Raiders in an absolutely crazy game by 6 points, and he got 2 points for that. So Tom has 5, Jordan has 4, Peter has 2, and we're heading into week 3.
Love it.
Yeah, you said there was no monsoon with the Bears game. I would also say there was no moon.
There certainly has not. It is a new moon.
Darnell Mooney finished with -4 yards receiving in week 2, which means that, Peter, you had more receiving yards than Darnell Mooney on Sunday.
Peter's quicker, too.
That's my ticket to fame. That's going on the business cards, going on the resume. We need a name for that. Should it just be a Mooney? If you get negative receiving yards, is that what we call it now?
It's the full Mooney.
The full Mooney?
Negative receiving yards total. This isn't he just caught one behind the line on a screen and ran backwards, whatever. This is he finished the entire game. So I can't even use that excuse. My keeper pick from this last season on my team, I was like, Darnell Mooney, let's go. Christian Kirk, you can get out of here. I'm fine with saying no to Christian Kirk, and I'll go with Darnell Mooney. And now it's an embarrassing Richmond of losses. Embarrassing Richmond of losses is what I just said.
That's the full moon.
Let's just move on, okay?
That's the full moon in Virginia, I think, is the Richmond of losses, yes.
Wait, huh?
What's that? Do you guys hear that?
No, not now.
That's Bet the Bet. Let's go! That's right. Welcome to another edition of Vet the Bet. This is the hottest new game show on the internet, where I, your host, Tom Haverster, research the history of a particular bet, and I quiz our esteemed panel of contestants, that's Jordan Brenner and Peter Keating, about the findings. Are you ready, Peter and Jordan, to play Vet the Bet?
No. Haven't we embarrassed me enough? Does this have to keep going on week after week?
Vet it, baby. Let the vetting begin.
Let's vet the bet. There are four teams who are currently 0-2 in the win-loss column and 0-2 against the spread. Those poor four teams are the Tennessee Titans, right, Peter? Las Vegas Raiders, the Cincinnati Bengals, and the Carolina Panthers. So, in the last 10 seasons in the NFL, there have been 63 times in which a team has played in September after a two-game losing streak on both the money line and against the spread. What is their win percentage against the spread coming off that two-plus game losing streak in September? So I want you to right now submit your answers in a direct message to me, and the closest answer will win. Peter has clocked in with his answer. Final answer, Peter has guessed for his against the spread win percentage of those lovable losers, disappointing losers, I guess I should say, 50.5%.
Right. And I hope that you will appreciate that it's not just 500 because we're talking about an odd number of teams.
He doesn't even think it's 50%. He's just trying to beat me with strategic like $1. And, yeah.
I do think it's 50% because week three, just like the third year for a quarterback, is crucial, because your third opportunity to evaluate somebody or something is your chance to see whether the arrow went down and down and is just going to fall through the floor, like I began the show saying, or whether they're a little bit better than they look and there's some bounce back potential. And against the spread, I think probably it's about half and half. So it's half and half adjusted for the odd
number. Okay. All right.
Jordan, do you have any reasoning at all, or are you just—
Well, just wait.
Are you just throwing darts during Vet the Bet these days?
I'm being attacked here, Tom. As the host, you need to have control over your contestants.
All right. 57% is Jordan's guess.
Wow, that's bold. That's bold.
The answer, 60.3%. Jordan, how does it feel?
You know, I'd like to thank Maze for putting this together, and Tom for hosting the show. My family really, you know, stuck with me through down times.
Yeah.
It's good. It feels good.
You came in with a very close to the correct answer, but both of you came in a little lower than the truth. So if you wagered $100 on those two-game losing streaks in both categories in September, early in the season, if you wagered $100 on them to cover the spread in each of those games, you'd have $955 in profit in your pocket. If you pick those teams, those 0-2 teams, if you pick them straight up, you'd go 30-32-1 with $1,562 in your pocket. So these guys, like the Titans, the Panthers, the Bengals.
The Bengals and the Raiders.
And the Raiders are 0-2 in both categories. And if you had bet those teams over the last 10 years, those types of teams over the last 10 years, you'd have like $2,500 in your pocket. And over the last five seasons, what's interesting is the bet has even been more successful. In 27 games, they've won 70% against the spread and 13-13 on the money line for a whopping total of $1,400 of winnings if you bet them. And in the worst case scenario, two-game losing streak on both the money line and the against the spread on both bets, September playing on the road. So in this week, that would be the Bengals at the Jets and then the Raiders at fellow poor four member the Titans. Okay, on the road in both categories, playing in September, they are actually better than the overall record. So like, this is kind of big. I feel like we should, I don't know, Jordan, I guess you can bet on this. I like this.
Well, here's my question. Do you think that message is sinking in with the public at all? Because of the four 0-2 teams, not many of them are deep underdogs this weekend.
Bengals are favorites.
Yeah.
Pretty significant favorites.
So, I mean, in our underdog picking where we're looking for dogs who are deeper than 3 points, right? I don't think you can bet any of those four teams, can you?
So the Bengals are 5-point favorites at the Jets. The Raiders are 2-point favorites in Tennessee, and it's rare to have these September losers not be underdogs, right?
Right.
But you'd fare better picking those favorites. September overdogs, Peter. September overdogs coming off of 2-game losing streaks on both the money line and the spread over the last 10 seasons. There's only 25 instances of this that we're seeing with the Bengals and the Raiders where they're favorites, even though they're 0-2 on both categories. Those teams, the September overdogs, 0-2 records, are 14-9 against the spread.
Wow. So that there really is. That seems to be a signal, right?
And they've covered 7 of the last 9 times this scenario popped up. So even if they are the favorite, there might be a little bit of edge there that we're not quite quantifying in the spread.
I mean, this seems to speak to, again, some of the stuff we talked about with Danny Sheridan last week about teams bouncing back, about teams never being as good as they look when they're up and not being as bad as they look when they're down. The human nature aspect to this, it makes sense to me. It's why I thought that it would be a profitable, and I think 57% is not too far off from 60%. So I like this. I was already thinking about this, you know, as we make our picks for this week. I also wonder if there's, maybe you can research this for next time, Tom, what we can say about teams that start fast. And maybe, is it a mirage? And I'm thinking, of course, in particular, about a team that's near and dear to our hearts, the New York Football Giants.
Yes.
Who are 2-0. It has been incredibly fun to watch as a fan. It's the first time I wake up feeling some sort of optimism about them in ages. But I'm also realistic enough to say they're not that good right now. The margin is very thin. They needed, you know, a 2-point conversion and a missed field goal to get by in Tennessee. That Carolina game could have gone any number of ways, any number of times. They won by a field goal. But I've had this theory, guys, for a long time in football, which is this, that in some cases, you know, you would think a team improves and then wins. Sometimes I think a team wins and then gets good. What do I mean by that? I mean that a team may not be that talented, may not be that good a team, but they get a couple fortunate breaks, they get an easy schedule, and suddenly they're looking at a 3-0 record, and that actually helps them become a better team because they're playing with more confidence. They believe in the system. They believe in the coach. The quarterback's making better decisions and so forth. So while it may not make them run faster or may not be able to make them block harder, I do think that the little things that are important in football may crystallize around winning. So I wonder if the Giants getting off to this fast start, they're home against the Cowboys on a Monday night with Cooper Rush. They've got an incredibly easy schedule going forward. We may look at the Giants later in the season and be like, you know what? They are a good team now. And was it the result of early success? Does this make any sense, guys? Or am I talking out of my ass?
Well, usually you are, but
turns out that that's not mutually exclusive, Jordan.
So you're saying my ass makes a lot of sense?
Well, when you make sense, maybe it's generally your ass making the sense. I don't know. I don't know what I'm saying about that. Let me say this. You're right. It doesn't make winning doesn't necessarily make people block better or run faster, but winning does create an environment where it's probably easier to make good in-season changes, right? And that also involves health. I mean, the Giants still have a considerable number of injuries, particularly on their defensive line, right? Which needs to be functioning well and better for them to be any good, because we still just don't know about the quarterback going to be able to keep anything going for the season. I mean, but, you know, they need Ojulari and Thibodeau back and healthy. And if you can win a couple of games and bank those while you're getting healthy, maybe they will be better in 4 to 6. They should be, right? They should be better in 4 to 6 weeks than they are now. So much of analytics focuses on evaluating talent and figuring out who has the best rosters at the beginning of the season, evaluating off-season moves. I think and then so much of the in-season is random that we probably don't do as good a job in general as we might figure out who's going to get better as opposed to just revealing themselves for what they were already at, right? Who's going to actually get better over the season? I think, you know, 2 wins, right, against soft opposition, sure. I mean, the Giants have the 24th best simple rating system method in the league, and they're 2-0. So have they been lucky? Obviously. But it's sure better to be 2-0 looking forward to making changes that are going to make you better than it is to be 1-1 or 0-2.
Listen to their upcoming schedule for a second, okay? Home against the Cowboys with no Dak. Home against the Bears. At the Packers with no wide receivers. home against the Ravens. That's a tough one. At the Jaguars, at the Seahawks, home against the Texans, home against the Lions. None of those eight games is impossible to win. You could be a mediocre team and get through that 5-3, right?
Yeah. What was our hopeful scenario for them this season a month ago? Winning 7 games or 8 games?
Well, someone here bet the over on 6.5 wins, so feeling pretty good about that.
So maybe that's 8 or 9 wins. That would be a pretty successful season, right? Of course, Jordan, if they're a little bit better, so they're improved at the margins and their health improves, but their luck, you know, evens out, where does that put them? 8 or 9 wins, which is just, are they improving to the point where they're just going to be just good enough to not get a really good quarterback in next year's draft? That's the long range question for me.
Yeah, they're not going to get a good enough pick for a really good quarterback, but I believe in Daniel Jones. I'll see if Brian Daboll does, but I do not think he is or has been the problem. If this line can block finally, and they actually, you know, decide on which receivers are going to play, I think he's going to have a good season.
We need a Casey Joyner metric for percentage of throws that nobody understands unless the quarterback was trying to throw to the opposing team. And I'm pretty sure that when we devise that metric, Daniel Jones will be the runaway leader. So I hope that with better blocking, I hope better blocking's coming, and I hope with better blocking he stops throwing passes that look like he was throwing to the opponent, but I don't know how you can be confident in that.
Oh, no. Do you hear that?
Uh-oh.
That's right. We have another round of Bet the Bet real quick.
Oh, no.
Let's go! The Giants, being 2-0 on the money line and against the spread, coming in as the slight favorite here against the Cowboys on Monday night. Jordan, you asked for it. Here you're going to get it. Since 2012, there have been 53 teams who are the favorite coming off of a 2-game win streak in September on the money line and against the spread, a la the New York Giants. What is their win percentage against the spread in those games coming off that hot streak as the favorite? So it's the flip side of what we were talking about earlier. All right. Jordan has come in. 45% is his guess. Jordan Brenner, 45%. Peter Keating is coming in at 39.5. Wow. Okay. 39.5. The answer is 41.5.
Oh!
Peter Keating is the winner on this one. He avenges his loss earlier in the episode. Yeah, 22-31. The Giants. That's not looking good for your New York Giants coming up on Monday night. But that's interesting. So ride the losing teams and fade the super hot teams that have been overachieving early at this stage.
Are there any other sort of besides the Giants early season underdogs who caught your eye that are better than you thought they were going to be or look like they're going to be a surprise team for the rest of the season?
Well, yeah, I mean, the Dolphins, right? The Dolphins with that ridiculous performance there. If you started Tua and Waddle and Tyreek Hill, you would have won your fantasy. I mean, they all had 40 points in that game. It's insane. So, like, are the Dolphins legit? That offense looks great.
I think the Eagles look better than I thought they would, too.
Yeah.
They look scary.
They look terrific.
I hate to say it.
Yeah, I do, too. At the extent to which Cousins literally couldn't throw the ball, just didn't have any time. Their defense looks scary. And, yeah, they just look scary overall. I mean, they're going to run away with that division, don't you think? I hate to say that, but...
Well, not according to Jordan.
That's right.
Giants are going to run away with it.
Yeah, the runaway train.
Are you tired of snooty wines and their old world wine culture? Confused by words like malolactic fermentation? Yeah, we are too. So with 19 Crimes, you can do the fancy schmancy tilt, sip, smell. Ooh, I think it tastes like old red cherry, a little bit of wood and mahogany, a little leather. You can do all that stuff or don't. 19 Crimes is the rebel of wine culture telling stories of rogues and rule breakers who overcame adversities. From convicts banished to Australia to the legendary icon Snoop Dogg himself. 19 Crimes wine is defiant by nature, bold in character, and always uncompromising. 19 Crimes, the official wine of the UFC. Pick up in stores nationwide or online at 19crimes.com. Enjoy responsibly. Copyright 2024, Sonoma, California.
People are all over the place, traveling, working, in and out, looking for quick and easy, yet also healthy meals. So eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options. These include popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, Veggie, and Vegan. Also, discover more than 60 add-ons every week, like breakfast, on-the-go lunch, snacks, beverages to help you stay fueled and feel good all day long. What are you waiting for? Get started today and fuel up for your springtime goals.
You can get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can get back to doing what you love this spring. You're looking for gourmet meals? I always am. Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. It's no fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning up. Simply heat and savor the good stuff. And man, do I like the good stuff. It's tailored to your schedule. Customize your weekly meals with the flexibility to get as much or as little as you need. Pause or reschedule deliveries to suit your lifestyle. And look, we're celebrating Earth Day all month long. Look out for the Earth Month Eats badge on the menu for our lowest carbon footprint meals. There's a lot you can do to help the environment, and Factor is there for you. So head to factormeals.com/dogs50 and use code dogs50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code dogs50 at factormeals.com/dogs50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Remember the best vacation you've ever taken? Make your next one even better with Get Your Guide. With Get Your Guide, you can book over 100,000 unforgettable experiences in the U.S. and around the world. Want to see the Grand Canyon from a helicopter? They got you. Watching a wrestling match in Mexico City? No problem. Or how about a guided tour of Rome's ancient ruins? Wherever you're going, whatever you're into, book your next travel experience at getyourguide.com.
All right, well, let's do our weekly underdogs here. Why don't we start things off with Peter Keating? Congratulations, coming off the win and Vet the Bet, recovering after a devastating defeat at the hand of Jordan Brenner. Now you have the first pick, and I'm going to go through here. Actually, Jordan, you have it in front of you probably. The teams that are available to be picked in our weekly dog draft.
All right, here are our options this week. You've got the Pittsburgh Steelers getting 4.5 points at Cleveland on Thursday night. The Colts getting 6.5 points at home against Kansas City. The Dolphins, who we talked about, getting 5.5 at home against the Bills. The Jets getting 5 at home against the Bengals. The Commanders getting 6.5 at home against the Eagles. The Lions getting 6 at Minnesota. The Jaguars getting 7 at the Chargers. And the Cardinals getting 3.5 at home against the Rams. All the other games have a spread of 3 or fewer points, so they are off our board.
It is a sorry lot of choices, too.
It really is. It really is.
And the teams that are recent discussions and that analytics would lead you to like are almost all off the board because the margins are too close, right? I believe I have the first pick this week, right?
You do.
And you have thoroughly explained why Cincinnati, who is favored coming off being 0-2 overall and against the spread, is a strong bounce back candidate, right? We went into that in considerable detail, but here's one thing we didn't talk about. Maybe the most consistent way you can make money on underdogs is to fade the public. Over the last 5 years, teams that had a majority of money bet on them, or majority of the public bets as underdogs, we're 11-18-1 against the spread. If you have 60% or more of public money bet, we're 2-10-1 against the spread.
So basically popular underdog picks.
Right. The Jets have the lowest share of bets placed on them of any team in the NFL this week.
That's my favorite Jets stat. Yes. Okay. There's a lot of them, but that's pretty good. A New York market has the fewest amount of bets placed on that team.
Yeah. Now, you know that odds makers are trying to get the money 50-50, but despite shifts in the spread, the Jets at plus five have just 12% bet on them. Now, look, Cincinnati eked out a win. They got Miami next week at home. The Jets are at home. Their defense is legit. Their receivers are terrific. That was an insane ending last week, but they've operated really well on defense and really efficiently last week on offense. You know, they need a tight end who won't fumble the ball every time he touches it. But that's kind of a quibble at this point with a spread of 5 points at home against a team that has stumbled around a lot so far this season. So again, yes, it makes sense that Cincinnati should be a bounce back candidate. But for the second week in a row, I find myself, for reasons of betting lines and the selections that we're trapped into, and also a grudging admiration for what the Jets have been able to put together, to go with the New York Jets against Cincinnati.
Well, with my first pick, and I agree that it's a struggle to find really good underdogs this week and really good lines, I'm going to stick with an underdog that I've liked since April, when I put money on their chance to win the division and their over total on wins. I'm going with the Detroit Lions at Minnesota, getting 6 points. I wish it were seven. It's not. But I hope I'm not over-indexing for what we saw out of Minnesota against the Eagles. But it's a division matchup. These teams play some strange games over their history. I think the Lions are looking good, particularly on offense. I could see this being sort of a high-scoring back-and-forth game. The over-under right now is 52.5. And I think the Lions, even if it's a backdoor cover late, can do enough to keep this thing close enough. Maybe even eke out a win. You know, you just don't know with Kirk Cousins. So I'm going to go with Amon-Ra St. Brown and the Detroit Lions getting six.
Well, after we saw the Eagles last week, what the Lions did against them looks a little more impressive, doesn't it? And it was impressive at the time. So that's a cool pick, I think.
Thank you, Peter.
We just continue to love the Lions, right? They're an easy team to root for. And it makes sense. And the betting line hasn't caught up with them yet. Yeah, why not? And you're right about Kirk Cousins. Who can depend on him? I don't know. I guess Minnesota can, but we'll find out. But I like that pick.
I'm actually starting Kirk Cousins this week in fantasy. So
all right, well,
I benched Tom Brady. Good luck with that pick. All right, with my pick, I actually had Detroit high on my big board as well, Jordan. I'm going to go with the tried and true Jacksonville Jaguars plus seven at the Chargers. Quarterback is hurt, Chargers, and I don't think that when we look at that Chargers team and our boy Austin Ekeler, I don't think they should be 7-point favorites. Now, I'm not going to get the 3-point max here if the Jacksonville Jaguars, if the Jags pull off the upset. I'm not going to get full 3 points, because if it locks in at 7, we need it to get to 7.5, right? In order for me to get the max 3 points.
Correct. And we're going with these lines today. So,
all right. Well, I'm going to stick locked with the Jags plus 7. At the Chargers, we're banged up, and Ekeler, he hasn't looked great around the goal line, hasn't been getting the opportunities that he said he was going to get. He might have a bounce back game, but I'm still thinking they're going to save him, put him on ice for the postseason run. So I'm going to go with the Jags plus 7 this coming weekend. And as for my second pick here on the turn, I'm going to go with the Dolphins plus 5.5 at home going against Buffalo. I think this offense is that good. 5.5 is a little too high for me, so I'm going to go with the Miami Dolphins at home.
I struggled with that one. I wanted to pick it, and then Buffalo just looks so good. And that defense looks so good, and they can get pressure. I get the logic behind it, but are they sort of a mirage a little bit at 2-0? Is Buffalo really the only dominant team in the league? I don't know.
I have to admit, for the teams that have posted just runaway offensive performances, I am hesitant so far, because I think while Buffalo may be the most complete and overall most dominant team, there are a couple of teams whose offenses are just scarily capable of throwing up 40 points. And I hesitate to disagree with a moderate or low spread against those teams. So I worry about the same thing.
Jordan, you're up.
All right. For my second pick, I'm going to stick to some of the same logic we talked about earlier in the show, and I'm going to take the Washington Commanders at home, getting 6.5 against the Eagles. We just talked about fading 2-0 teams. We've talked about sort of divisional matchups. Weird things can happen. Obviously, this is the great Carson Wentz revenge game. here. Washington's moved the ball on offense both weeks. And, you know, as good as we think the Eagles look, I think a division game here, again, I could see this being a field goal game either way. So give me Washington plus 6.5.
Not a bad pick. We don't have any huge long shots, none eligible for that 3-point boost. So Jacksonville's the longest.
I was a little bit torn between that and the Colts, but I had to go with, you know, when you have a chance to pick Carson Wentz, how can you not?
Were you the one that picked the Colts and Matt Ryan being, did I remember that?
I think I had Matt Ryan as an underdog MVP pick. That's looking fantastic right now.
So it sounds like you bailed on that one already.
I may have bailed on that one.
The fact that you didn't pick the Colts, it was ripe for you to take the Colts as the fifth pick in this draft. You still are staying away from the Colts. You're burnt.
We should set up a prop bet for how many more yards will Lamar Jackson have than Matt Ryan at the end of the year? Will it be 2,000 more yards? Maybe 1,000 more yards? I don't know. Jordan, what are you giving as the over-under on that gap right now?
We should do Lamar Jackson's rushing yards against Matt Ryan's passing.
That would be awesome.
All right, what do you got, Peter?
I'm going to wrap this up with, there's only a few teams left to pick.
Yeah, you got three possible picks.
But I think one of them is a pretty fine pick, which is the Pittsburgh Steelers. Plus 4.5 against Cleveland. What? The over-under on this game is 38.5. They're going to have 20-mile-an-hour winds. It's going to rain. These teams always play each other close. Najee Harris is still alive and
is he?
Is well, is he? As far as we can tell. He is healthy. So what gives? I mean, this is going to be a close, nasty game with poor quarterback play. That makes it a slugfest, a 50-50 game. What more do you want to pick an underdog, especially one who's not, you know, we're not talking 6.5, 7 to 7.5 points.
May, since our show drops on Fridays, can't you just do a little editing and just change Peter's pick to whichever team lost Thursday night?
Or just make fun of him if the Browns blow him out. Just add a line.
Yeah, little voiceover.
It did not work.
You lost.
Yeah. This is what I don't understand. Like you're picking the Steelers here. And you're talking about how it's going to get really messy and it's going to be one on the ground. And on the other side, you got probably the best duo in the backfield with Nick Chubb and Kareem Hunt. And you're betting against that team?
Well, to be specific, my other choices are going with an underdog against the Rams or against the Chiefs, right? Yeah, look, I think Pittsburgh has enough weapons that they can hang with a ground game. Hey, what do you want me to say? They got a good kicker.
Enough of this pigskin nonsense. All right. I can feel the wind growing a bit chillier. I can feel the leaves starting to change.
Wait. Before you go there, can I just ask you a quick question, Jordan? Didn't your guys' research say that teams from outside the top six in college football never make the championship? That was what our earlier research showed, right?
I can smell the disgusting scent of a pumpkin spice latte.
Before Jordan says something about the Yankees, I just want to point out that USC is ranked 7th this week.
Don't do it.
So as the juggernaut...
I can hear Peter talking.
As the juggernaut rolls on, they're still worthy of consideration as an underdog.
There's no need to fear
or quaver.
Underdog is here to save her. Underdog.
That's right. Right around the corner, it's playoff baseball. And by the time this podcast drops, Aaron Judge, who's currently sitting at 60 home runs after a dramatic Yankee victory on a walk-off grand slam by Giancarlo Stanton last night, Judge may be at 65 by the time this drops. You never know. But here's the thing, guys. We hear this in every sport. We hear it in baseball a lot. How much does how you finish on the season matter?
Wait just a second. Before we get off the subject that you brought up, Jordan, give us your opinion. If Aaron Judge hits 63 home runs, will he be the all-time home run champion?
No, we're not doing this.
This is not part of the show.
I just want to make sure.
I don't want to hear Jordan's take on...
I don't even want to hear Jordan's
take. I just want to make sure we have Jordan on record defining Aaron Jones as the plucky 7-foot-tall...
He's the running back for the Green Bay Packers.
Yeah, that's Aaron Jones.
What are you talking about?
You said Aaron Jones.
I said Aaron Judge, and I'm wondering if you are...
Baze, can you play this back?
I just want to make sure we have Jordan on record defining Aaron Jones as the plucky 7-foot underdog from New York.
Anyway, you hear about teams going in the postseason hot, going in cold, fading down the stretch. Does any of that matter? So, Tom, you wrote about this years ago, and then we updated your research. Tell us what you found initially, and then maybe we'll let Peter talk again and add to your research.
So when I was a young floppy-haired gent in the research room at ESPN, the other campus, not the real cool campus. This was that when I was at the Superior Building back at ESPN with no windows and it's just basically a warehouse. I wrote a story for ESPN the magazine. I believe Chad Millman edited this story, or at least greenlit it. And it was basically, hey, last 10 games of the season, if you are really hot in those last 10 games, what happened after that? Did you win the World Series? Did you not? What if you were super cold? You lose seven out of those 10 games. And then what do you go in? You go in freezing cold into the postseason. What happens? And what I did find is that all of those hot streaks, the sizzling teams that everyone wants to bet because they look great, are actually less likely to win the World Series than the teams that come in super cold. And there's a lot of reasons for that, I think, why those hot streaks plays tricks on our mind about recency bias, confirmation bias. We remember the hot streaks like the Colorado Rockies, I think in 2007 was it, that just went on an absolute tear and won the World Series. We remember those, but we don't remember the runs where I think the Yankees lost 14 of their last 18 games going into the postseason, and then they went on a run in the World Series and won it all. So basically, my story in ESPN the magazine, the very first one that I wrote, was about how momentum is bullshit, to say it eloquently. Now, I don't know if it's still bullshit. Is it a steaming pile of dung, or is it actually the myth is now the truth? What's the new data say?
Yeah, so Peter and I picked up from where Tom left off with the past, 10 to 12 years. And Peter, what'd we find?
Since we've had wildcard teams, 41 teams in the wild card era have made the playoffs after finishing the regular season going 8-2 or better over their final 10 games. Simple criteria. Only five out of 41 have gone on to win it all. 12 playoff teams went 3-7 or worse in their final 10 games, and three of them, almost as many, won championships. This is really wild. The correlation between the records teams have in their final 10 games and their postseason wins is 0.12.
Which means it's pretty much random.
It's almost random. Yeah, correlation goes from -1, which is perfectly inverse, like the higher I go, the lower you go, all the way up through 0, which means no relationship at all between two things, to 1, which is a perfect correlation.
And this was 0.12.
0.12. And the correlation between team records in September and regular season October, you put them together, those games and their number of postseason wins is 0.05, essentially zero. There is no relationship between how teams finish the season and how well they then go on to perform in the postseason. It is hard to think like, it's hard to accept that because we do remember teams like the Braves last year, right? They essentially remade their team on the fly. They won 9 out of their last 10 games in the regular season. Nobody saw them coming. They went on to win the World Series. Those kinds of teams tend to stick in our minds, but they don't represent what actually happens overall.
Right. And in fact, in this period, we started in 2010, right, Peter? In this period, we looked at the 10 best September/October regular season records we found. None of those teams won a World Series. 2 lost in the World Series, but then it's just a mix. Teams that lost in the division. You had the 2013 Indians had the second best record of that whole group. They lost in the wild card and so forth. Then if you look at the teams with the worst September-October record, you had a World Series winner in there. You had the 2015 Royals, and you've got teams that made it to the ALCS, made it to the NLCS. The 2017 Dodgers had the second worst September-October record in that group. They lost in the World Series. So even if you go to the extremes of these situations, you're still finding that teams had any kind of if you go to the extremes, you're finding that teams had no rhyme or reason to how they did in the postseason.
And look, year in, year out now, because we have wild card teams, you'll see teams that go 88-74 or 89-73. They might win a wild card game. They might lose a wild card game. Teams now shepherd their aces to pitch in that first wild card game if they have to. So those teams with those aces, if they do win, don't have those aces for the next series. You'll also see them beat or lose to teams that win 94 or 98 games. There just isn't that big enough of a difference between a 95-win team and an 88-win team to expect anything different. I mean, if you step back and think about it, we got more teams playing. It's easier for any team to get knocked off. So this really, I think, should make us appreciate teams that make it to the postseason and stop this, you know, stop this incessant demand for winning championships. There just is no way to guarantee that you're going to win once you get to the postseason.
So I guess the takeaway here is, yes, it is pretty much random. So don't fall prey to the confirmation or the recency bias of like picking the hot team. It might actually be that the coldest team wins the World Series this year. You shouldn't be surprised by that. So I guess there's a lot of reasons for this, the randomness, right? That there is no momentum or statistically it seems like a mirage. Resting starters right down the stretch. You see Gonsolin for the Dodgers. He's being rested. They're working him back from a forearm injury, which is really scary, but who knows? Maybe, you know, they turn it on and he becomes an ace again and they're going to be fine. The other thing is resting guys in the order, just like, hey, we're going to take you out. You know, you had two at bats. We're going to just rest you for the rest of the game. And maybe they're not putting all their cards on the table, just strategically in that final month. They're just kind of taking a seat back. So I guess like right now, as we speak, the Philadelphia Phillies have lost five games straight and they're still projected to make the playoffs. So that's a team that like I actually might bet on going into the postseason if they make it, if they continue to slide, not play great baseball. I just think you shouldn't hate or fade on the cold teams and don't get too indulgent on the teams that are doing really well. Right now it's the Mets. The Mets are on a six-game win streak. Let's see what happens going forward. But if that continues, I still don't see the Mets getting there at the end.
And I think the most interesting thing you said was the last 10 games, I didn't expect to see anything, any kind of correlation with the last 10 because of all the reasons you said. The best teams often aren't even playing their best players in the last 10 games. I was more interested. To me, the September-October record, larger sample, larger time period, I was curious whether that mattered. It obviously doesn't. But, you know, it also makes me wonder, well, is there anything that is a harbinger to playoff success? Like, if we looked at pitching over the last month, is there such a thing as hot pitching? I think we can all agree that hitting is just, you know, it's a series of streaks one way or another, and there's really no way to go in to any kind of a series with hitting momentum. But I do wonder if maybe we can look this up for next week. If a pitcher's, you know, found his stuff in September and October, if that matters going into the playoffs.
Well, you know, a lot of this gets circular and it would be interesting to study, but because of what you and Tom are saying, the things to look at, to isolate, to see if they matter, have to do with how teams are deploying their resources in a pennant race, right? And so you want to see, you want to specify somehow, you want to get in and find out which teams had something to fight for so they used their best players, but they didn't exhaust them, right? And somehow those will be the teams that go on to win, except those aren't always the best teams overall, so that momentum kind of gets lost in the wash when you're looking at quality. Right now, do the Astros have a six-man, a seven-man, a five-man, an eight-man rotation? Who the hell knows? They're playing whoever they want to try to start seeing who they want to play in the playoffs. They've been doing this for a month because their lead is so big. They're going to win 106, 10, whatever games anyway. That quality is what's going to matter no matter how much they tinker for 10 games or a month. And, you know, it's hard to say. Yeah, I mean, teams that are fighting for a spot will use their best players. Does that necessarily mean those best players will continue to perform in the postseason? So it's actually a hard thing to study beyond the records because you have to get kind of figure out what teams are trying to do and whether it succeeds.
Well, I guess one other thing I wanted to say about this, and we'll move on to more important matters, rosy things that we can talk about.
There's nothing more important than whether the Mets are going to win in the postseason.
One thing I thought about is those cold teams that we talked about, that pile of frigid cold teams that are stumbling to the finish line of the regular season and getting into October. Don't you have to be so good that you still make the playoffs after being bad in the final 10 games or in the final month of the season. So it's almost baked in that you are a juggernaut. You know, if you're making the playoffs despite being terrible down the stretch, it almost kind of makes you more likely, in my head, to win the World Series, because you're just, you're lapping the field enough that you can still fall on your ass in the last stretch and make the playoffs. It just makes me think those teams are more interesting.
One interesting thing about that is that what you said obviously applies to the 2000 Yankees, which you brought up before, which are probably the best example of a team that stumbled all the way through September. And I don't think it was because they were resting a lot of guys. They just didn't play well, but then they turned around and won another World Series. But here's something interesting. There are hardly any teams that have gone 3-7 or worse in the two wild card era team. The past 10 years, there are very few teams that have finished the season poorly and then actually made the playoffs. And none have won the World Series, whereas your research showed from, I guess, from 95 to 2010, three had won the World Series. I think there probably is a, and figure out how to study this, but this is interesting. I think there probably is a greater competitiveness at the kind of very good level, right? Teams that could win between 85 or let's say 90 something games, they want to maximize their wins really badly because now they can make the postseason, right? So those teams are doing everything they can to try to not play poorly at the end of the year. So that's kind of interesting because then you get those teams into the postseason. They make things a lot more interesting. I think that I think there's probably a lot less poor play by contenders at the end of the season because of that. One other thing is the best teams are just winning a lot more games right now over the past 3 or 5 years than almost any time in baseball history. So yeah, if a team like the Dodgers or the Astros winning 105 games every year, going 7-3 or 8-2 or 9-1 at the end of the year really isn't that crazy. And they're almost never going to go 2-8 or 3-7 over a stretch at all. Even if they're playing their backups, they probably won't.
It is going to be cool, by the way, to see, starting with this year, this new playoff format and what the effect of, you know, playing a three-game series has on, you know, resources, starting pitching in particular, and how much better those 1 and 2 seeds come out of it now. But guys, before we go, last night was something. It was something.
Oh my God.
It was the Bachelorette finale. I'm still not sure what I watched. I'm still not sure what was scripted and what wasn't. I'm still not sure if I can eat today. Help me make sense of this.
Who did Tino call in the backyard?
I thought he was talking to one of the producers, no?
Oh, he was on the phone. He was on the phone, shirt unbuttoned his shirt, and she comes out to confront him, and he's on the phone and like looks, he's smiling, and that has to be the girl. That has to be the mistress.
So did you think that he was gaslighting her, she was gaslighting him, or they were both gaslighting each other?
Wait a minute. How could that be the other woman? That would be the most spectacularly poorly timed phone call in like TV history. That
I'm single, baby. We're over. We're over.
Wow.
I'm out.
Here to deliver the good news, sweetie. We can do this for real. We don't have to dance around this. And it's not a tiny hookup anymore. Yeah. Not a tiny mistake. This is a big one.
That's some poor impulse control.
Answer my question, because my wife and I were discussing this while watching the show last night, because she thinks Rachel is like legit crazy. Again, so the question is, was she gaslighting him? Was he gaslighting her, or were they both gaslighting each other?
What was she gaslighting him about?
Yeah.
She was like constantly changing the terms of the conversation. And then like, she wants to know why it happened. And then he tries to explain. She's like, you're blaming it on me. And he's like, well, no, I'm just trying to explain to you what I was thinking. And then,
yeah.
Right. She kept like moving the goalposts. And it was very clear that he, at one point, he had like no idea what she was talking about. Again, he seems like a total tool also, and to cheat on her is totally unacceptable, but I don't like the easy narrative, and that ABC has to protect its cast members is to make him the bad guy and make her, you know, the strong woman who persevered. I think she sucks too.
All right, so I say that when you look at that situation, there was a little bit of like a gap
of information that is not going to be made public. That they talked about something.
Yeah, like what the hell did... when she's like, do you want to get into what we talked about? And he's like, what? Does he have a small animal growing in his chest? Like what was this private matter?
A small animal growing in his chest would be the bizarre secret that the show was hiding in those last
words.
The logistics of this entire season, the logistics and the editing, the jumping from, I mean, it's been a 1-3 month long non sequitur. I mean, somebody has COVID, so they talk about it to some of the cast, but not the others. There are people wandering around alone on cruise ships. I am trying to figure out, it's now clear that Zach pursued a successful underdog strategy of self-eliminating so that he could be the next Bachelor. But if that's not something that Rachel knew about, because I still don't understand why they broke up. I don't understand the information that was presented to me on the screen. It was not enough to draw
well, that's another one
logical
of those
conclusions.
Something happened.
Yes, something happened. Yeah. We don't know what it is, except maybe he wanted to leave so because they told him he could be the Bachelor. But I think if Rachel is anywhere near as unaware of what was going on with the guys as we were watching, right? If she wasn't privy to some of the information that nobody's ever shared with us as viewers, and she's half as confused as I am, then I don't blame her at all for being ticked off and accelerating the confusion, because I didn't know what the hell was happening. I still don't, except that Zach is the next Bachelor, and that's going to give me another couple of extra weeks of free time over the next, you know, season, because...
Oh, what a boring season that's going to be.
Yeah, that's bedtime 8:30 p.m. I mean, that's just...
I mean, that guy could barely form a sentence when the girls came out at the end of the show yesterday. Holy cow.
Well, he couldn't name any of the women he had just met, and one of them barely gave him a mnemonic device.
And he said, her name was Balin. Is
Balin,
that even a name?
Yeah, yeah. It is. It is, but it's not former professor of history Bernard Balin.
It was Bailey.
Oh my gosh. I'm sorry, Maze. I didn't mean to scream into the microphone, but I mean, how about he batted zero on their name?
I don't know. The nerves. I mean, when you meet people, do you remember their names when you meet them at cocktail parties, or do you just...
Okay, Tomb. I guess you're right.
You're right.
If your one job was to date these five women...
on national television.
The one thing I would be saying is, Brianna, Brianna, Brianna.
Pick the one you like and remember her name at least. What a doofus.
Okay. Well, I want to go back to something real quick. Did our esteemed guest... our bachelor, bachelorette expert, were there any takeaways from her data that bore fruit in this season? Because didn't Tino win the first rose?
He got a first impression, yeah.
First impression rose.
Yeah, and that brings up an interesting fact, which is that the funnel really did narrow down when she said it would, which is when they began to travel, right? Around week 4 or 5. And the first impression rose seemed to have a lasting, like preseason college football polls had more significance than you might think. But you know, the producers know this stuff too, and they try to stay a step or two ahead of it. And they you know, if a trend becomes too likely, they're bound to try to, you know, mess with it or mix it up.
Literally the only intelligent thing that was said last night was actually in the text messages that that Eric had with the other girl, where he said, what did he say? None of this is real anyway, or something like that. And he's like, oh yeah, I didn't mean it. Now it's the most real thing in the world. No, no, none of it's real.
For those of us who placed a lot of hope in the franchise after Michelle and Nate's season, this was as big a disaster of programming as I've seen in a long time. This is like vapid people, massively confusing edits and kind of all of them crashing together in kind of like a Brownian motion of poor planning and poor results. And I mean, what do you make of any of this?
I don't know about you guys, but I was supremely uncomfortable by the Roman-esque like shaming of Tino on live television and having him watch Avon come in. It felt supremely cruel and felt wholly
dirty watching this thing.
Well, what did you text us? This is some WWE shit, right?
Yeah, this is some WWE shit, right? That's what I said. And the Aven coming out, like, oh my God, is that Aven's music? Oh my God.
Right.
Like that whole
the
thing.
The stare down.
Yeah, it was kind of like, it was amazing television, but I also recognize, like, I'm defending the predator here, who was the guy who cheated on her, and now I'm kind of like feeling bad for him, and that is a very conflicting emotion. But it did feel incredibly, like, I don't know, gladiator type. We're just gonna watch this guy get ripped to shreds.
It's a freeing thing when you just say they all suck, and they're and then don't look at it as defending Tino, but just also ripping Rachel and Aven. They all suck. So you owe no one anything. Owe no one any positive thoughts. I think it's ridiculous that she's supposedly in love with him, and it's like, he broke her heart. Oh, now I'm going to go off and I'm totally fine. Let's go out, Aven. And then this guy's like, well, the only mature thing that was said the whole season was when I said, you know, I want to date you. I'm not ready for an engagement. And of course she's like, I want to be engaged.
Yeah, but like, that was right? bad.
And now he's back. He's like, still want to date. But it's like, sure, second choice. I'm happy to, like, forget it. This is all ridiculous. It's staged. I don't believe any of these people even knows what they want. Gross.
I'm not giving into that complete nihilism. I don't think it was great TV. Like on Bachelor in Paradise, as loony as it is, there's cruelty and there are confrontations and there, but sometimes they just like, they pop up. Sometimes people get irritated with each other, want to fight each other, or want to steal men or women from each other. Sometimes you can just see in their behavior and their reactions that it's kind of spontaneous and kind of genuine. Nothing about that showdown last night. That was just, it was gratuitous cruelty and gratuitously staged confrontation. And just, I mean, this attempt to you know, have that cockfight was just a big fail.
We won't be seeing the double Bachelor, Bachelorette, I don't think, anytime soon. Poor Jesse Palmer having to navigate that whole thing because it was brutal. And then him saying, wow, this is awkward, huh, Tino? What's standing out here? You and me? Wow, let's move on from that. It was a season to forget, but on this podcast, lots of stuff to get into for next year.
But another podcast to remember. Thank you, Maze, for another bang-up job editing. We will see you guys next week.
Are all over the place, traveling, working, in and out, looking for quick and easy, yet also healthy meals. So eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options. These include popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, Veggie, and Vegan. Also, discover more than 60 add-ons every week, like breakfast, on-the-go lunch, snacks, beverages to help you stay fueled and feel good all day long. What are you waiting for? Get started today and fuel up for your springtime goals.
You can get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can get back to doing what you love this spring. You're looking for gourmet meals? I always am. Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. It's no fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning up. Simply heat and savor the good stuff. And man, do I like the good stuff. It's tailored to your schedule. Customize your weekly meals with the flexibility to get as much or as little as you need. Pause or reschedule deliveries to suit your lifestyle. And look, we're celebrating Earth Day all month long. Look out for the Earth Month Eats badge on the menu for our lowest carbon footprint meals. There's a lot you can do to help the environment, and Factor is there for you. So head to factormeals.com/dogs50 and use code dogs50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code dogs50 at factormeals.com/dogs50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.